When you have been raised in a religious system your whole life that really is not based on the living, breathing Jesus, but based on the traditions of humans, and then you come to meet the real living, breathing Jesus, the first startling thing that you find, and many of us have found that, is how different the church in general that wears Jesus' name, how different it is from Jesus himself in so many ways. And that's demoralizing. In fact, it's so disillusioning that it's easy to be cynical. I'm proud of anybody that has been a Christian for many years and is not cynical about the organized church, because it pretty much has been a failure historically, by and large, of doing what Jesus said to do in the way that he said to do it. So when we look at passages like we are looking at today as we work our way through Matthew's gospel, Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem, literally climbing the hill to Jerusalem from Jericho, same place our tour bus hung a right and headed up the hill towards Jerusalem. And he's leaving instructions with his followers. I would have been so depressed had I been him and realized how totally not on the same page the people I was leaving in charge were with God's agenda. It would have been so depressing. And I think it's significant that he was not depressed. He was willing to repeat himself. I'm so grateful that God repeats himself, because I leak. I leak on all the most important stuff. I can remember batting averages and statistics, football statistics, and, you know, car years and models and what changes they. I can remember all kinds of trivial, unimportant stuff. And the stuff that is the most important is the hardest to hold in my head. We're going to see Jesus for the fourth time that Matthew has recorded, telling his disciples what was going to happen when they got to Jerusalem. They didn't pay attention the first three times. There's good evidence in the text. They didn't pay attention this time. And I find it so amazing that he was willing to repeat himself. And the mercy of God, I think, is shown in who he does not fire. You know, that he knows we don't get it. I'm the king of doesn't get it, okay? In a lot of ways in my life, and I am so grateful for God's patience with me, repeating himself. So let's look and learn. We saw Jesus giving a parable about vineyard workers, which was very illuminating as to how God looks at service and reward, and it's very different than the way the world operates. And we're going to see once again today, it's the second or third time Jesus has mentioned something about the way God's kingdom operates that is completely contrary to any other kingdom in the world. In fact, it's so contrary that the church has adopted so many worldly principles regarding leadership and servanthood and all of those things that we look at what Jesus says to his disciples and it sounds to our brains, it sounds wrong. But it's his kingdom, remember. He's the king. He's not saying you have to agree with me, he's just saying this is the way I'm going to run my kingdom. And if you want to be part of it and you want to be have an active role, you need to be on the same page that I'm on. And so it's an excellent opportunity to be recalibrated. These are not the last times he's going to say these things. In the days and weeks ahead, on his way to the cross, he is going to say these things over and over. So let's open our hearts and receive what he has to say to us. I have about 6 pages worth of notes on about 10 verses. So there will be a few rabbit trails, which Wayne says is okay as long as there's a rabbit at the end of them. So we stopped at verse 16 of chapter 20. And let's pick up at verse 17. And I'm going to read as far as, I think we probably won't get any farther than verse 28. So I'm going to read through that just so we take it in its context. Now as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside and said to them, see if these words sound familiar. We are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and they will condemn him to death and will turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified, put to death on the cross. On the third day, he will be raised to life. Could it possibly be any clearer? This is the fourth time he said this. Did any of them remember when it was going down? No, they didn't. They all forgot. And he didn't fire them. Then, verse 20, the mother of Zebedee's sons, that would be James and John, Mark tells us that they put her up to it. Matthew is a little kinder. The mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and kneeling down. My NIV says kneeling down, but the Greek word is the word for worship. Proskuneo is the Greek word, which literally means to worship someone by giving them a kiss. It's a strong word. So I'm going to read it that way. Came to Jesus with her sons and worshiped him, asking a favor of him. There's a ready-made rabbit trail right there, isn't there? What is it you want? He asked. And she said, grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom. Mark tells us that they said something to him before she said this. They said, we want you to do whatever we ask you to do. And then, you know, the nudge to mom. And mom says, I want, you know, one to be vice president, one to be secretary of state when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said, you don't know what you're asking. Has he ever said that to you before? He said that to me a bunch of times. You don't know what you're asking. And Jesus said to them, that would be to James and John, can you drink the cup that I'm going to be drinking? The verb is a continuous action verb in Greek. So my NIV says that I'm going to drink, but it's a stronger phrase than that. I'm going to be constantly suffering before I get to that place of honor. Are you willing to go there with me? And they gave the typical guy answer. Same answer that almost any guy will answer if you say, can you lift that? They'll lie. Of course I can. By the way, how heavy is it? No, they said, we can. And Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. The implication, the temporal implication of the verbs would be here and now. I'm not going to be able to make that decision about who's going to sit at the right or the left here and now. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father. I don't know why, but I put a little smiley face by that because I thought God already knows who's going to be in those places of honor. The interesting thing is that some of them, one or two of them, may not have even been born yet. And God knows. Verse 24, this is also typical of guys. When the 10 heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. So Jesus called them together and said, you know, or you're familiar with the fact that the rulers of the Gentiles, those that are not God's people, they lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. The following four words are the most disobeyed words of Jesus in all of the history of Christianity. Take note. Not so with you. He said, that's not the way you're supposed to be. You read a church history book, we've obviously didn't take that seriously, did we? Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. If you have another translation that says minister, the Greek word is diakonos or diakonos, which is the word for a minister, but it means servant. And whoever wants to be first, by the way, they all did. We've already read about five times that they were arguing, arm wrestling verbally about who was going to be first. Okay, he says, you want to be first? Whoever wants to be first must be your slave. As unreasonable as that sounds, the next statement makes it all clear. He says, just as, or in exactly the same way, as the Son of Man, who did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Underline that word ransom, it's a great word. It may surprise you what it means. I know it did me. Okay, I promise you that's as far as we're going to get, but we've got a lot of territory to cover. So let's rewind. Rewind back up to verse 17 and strap yourselves in. I do find it's just so astonishing. You'd think the guys that were going to have their pictures in stained glass windows and, you know, have cities named after them and stuff, be famous in the religious world, you'd think they would have noticed something that Jesus repeated four times so far. We figured out between studying all four Gospels that we counted nine times he said this to them. And they all forgot. What would make God's servants not notice something so specific? It is a problem that we continue to have. It's a problem I have. It's a problem every person in leadership has. It happens when we have our own agenda. It's the Lord, take up your cross and follow me syndrome, you know, where we've got our dream, we have our plan, we have our tradition, we have our thing that we think is serving God. And God comes along and says, you know, that's not the way it's going to go down. And we don't even hear it because we hear the parts that fit into the agenda that we have. We're going to talk about that quite a lot today because it's interesting how many times we have misguided requests, like the mother of James and John, and James and John themselves who put her up to it, where we ask God for something and we don't have a clue what we're asking. We think we do, but we don't. I find it so interesting that at least a couple of the Gospels put these two stories temporally right one on top of each other. Jesus says, okay, here's how it's going to go down. It's not going to look like you think it's going to look. And yeah, suffering, death, yeah, we got it. By the way, could we ask you something? Could we be right up there with you in the places of importance? And obviously they didn't get it. I wrote a list, at least a sort of a streamlined one, of what it was that Jesus was about to face, which I find remarkable that he knew, even if they didn't. He knew exactly what was going to happen, and he went anyway. He obeyed anyway. It wasn't a surprise to him. It wasn't some sort of horrible mistake. The Bible said that he was sacrificed in God's mind's eye before the foundations of the world. It always was God's plan. It wasn't plan B, it was plan A. Here's the six things I wrote. He was about to face betrayal by a friend, seven things. Betrayal by a close friend, betrayal by the very people he came to rescue. He was about to be abandoned by his followers. Even these guys, even Peter, who at one point said, "Lord, I know you can't trust these other clowns. You know what losers they are. But I would take a bullet for you, Jesus. I would die for you." And there's that poignant phrase that says, after the events of Gethsemane, it says they all abandoned him. Everyone, his followers. He was about to face injustice. But especially poignant injustice, because he was going to face a mockery of a trial. In fact, it really wasn't a trial. It was just a formality they went through to look better. What they really wanted to do was to kill him. The shocking thing was who it was that was going to, you know, treat him with such injustice. It was the religious leaders of Israel. It was the people who studied the scriptures, who should have known better. They should have known who he was. It's amazing how jealousy can blind us. And these guys are such an example. Jesus said, you know, the people, I think it's interesting when he says, "I'm going to be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law." You can whiz right through that, because we know now, because we've seen the movie, right, that these were the bad guys. But you have to understand, to an entire nation, these were the people that were right up there with God. You would never think in your wildest dream that the chief priest, who was the chief representative between God and humans, you'd never think he would be the one that would commit an act of murder and injustice. And they didn't get that either. They were still shocked when it happened. He was mocked and humiliated by Romans. Of all the people that did bad stuff, I think they should probably get the lightest sentence. Most of them didn't even speak the same language. They didn't truly understand. In fact, it's interesting that there were more Romans in the account who changed their minds about Jesus and saw him for who he really was. There were more Roman soldiers that did that than there were religious leaders that did that. But they were specialists at mockery and humiliation. And one of the most humiliating ways that have ever been invented, talk about overkill. One of the most humiliating ways to execute somebody was the Roman invention of crucifixion. It wasn't just about dying. It was about dying in an excruciating way, in a way that would humiliate you and send a message to would-be rebels. He was about to face physical pain, the like of which we may not be able to comprehend. And Romans were known worldwide for torture, for getting the maximum amount of pain for the longest period of time out of someone they were killing. And ultimately, he was about to face death. The hardest thing was none of the above. He was going to experience for the very first time in his entire existence, all the way from eternity past, he was going to experience utter and complete separation from God. So that we wouldn't have to. Every kind of mental, emotional, physical strain lay ahead for us. And he took, it says, verse 18, he took his disciples aside. Excuse me, verse 17, and he said, and he told them. Why? Why would he tell them four times? But why did he want him to get it? It's kind of a revealing answer. Obviously, it's a rhetorical question. I already know what I want you to say. Yeah, It was to protect them from being shocked and surprised and taken by surprise. Why would you do that for somebody? Because you love them. Same reason my dad took me out in the Safeway parking lot on the first icy day and taught me how to drive my car when it went into an uncontrolled skid. Plus, he was really enjoying himself, too, so I'm sure that had something to do with it. I'm teaching my son. Yeah, then why are you giggling? No, you're doing it. No, he's saying, when you're whizzing down the state route in Oregon and you hit a patch of black ice and your car goes out of control, I want you to know what to do. It is going to happen at some point. I want you to know what to do so that you suffer minimal shock and damage. That's why he reminded them, and I think that's really important to keep in mind, because that's why he warns us about the stuff we don't pay attention to. He says, don't go down that road. There's pain down there like you can't believe, and we don't believe him until we walk down that road. Andrew Murray says, all of God's commands, when he says, don't do this, what he's really saying is, don't hurt yourself. They're words of love from our Creator. And of course, we don't believe it until we disobey, and then we see the pain. And we think, oh, I get it. That's why you told me. So, I wrote this down, because they all forgot anyway, no matter how many times he told them, they all forgot under pressure. He knew they would. That's why he just kept reminding them. I wrote this note to myself. Dear Bob, you need to listen when Jesus repeats himself, because you leak. And there's a reason why he repeats himself. If you have children that you love, you know exactly. In fact, the time when you see them absolutely not on the Clue bus, you realize they are not only not on the Clue bus, they're not even at the Clue bus stop. They're not in the same county as the Clue bus. It's driving around the block, honking its horn. They are not there. That's when you panic and you write notes. But that's what my grandma used to do, write notes and leave them on my pillow. Stick them inside a comic book, because you're going to need to know this. But here's something that I found as I was reading through this. It sort of jumped out and hit me, and then I thought about it, and I checked my facts, and I realized something that I had not taught. But you're welcome to check me out on this. I hadn't taught it before, but every time Jesus told them how he was going to die, he also told them that he was going to raise from the dead. Every time. The end of verse 19, on the third day, he even told them when. So picture what their lives would have been like. And of course, as we read through this, it's all unfolding in a few chapters. What would it have been like if they watched him being crucified? That would have been gruesome and horrible. But what if they'd remembered that he was only going to be in the grave 3 days? They would have had the world's longest tailgate party. They would have been camped out there in Gethsemane in that fabulous place where we sat and had communion. You guys probably did too when you went. They would have had, well, I was going to say barbecued pork ribs, but probably not, because some acceptable kosher barbecue food, perhaps some Manischewitz wine. They would have been... literally, they would have had the little thing with the 10, 9, 8, 7, you know, they would have been expecting the most amazing thing that had ever been done. Were they? No. They were hiding. They were running for their lives. They thought it was all over. Their hope had been crushed. Why on earth? Was it because they didn't know what was going to happen? No, they just didn't pay attention. Whenever he told them about his death, he gave them hope. My favorite word in the Bible, and I know, Bob, you say that about every word. Well, this is right up there in the top three words. It's the word hope. The Greek word is the word elpis, E-L-P-I-S. And it's not, oh, I hope the Celtics get into the playoffs. I hope that Kevin Garnett, you know, gets really well and blah, blah, blah. No, it's not wishful thinking. Elpis, hope, means the confident expectation of future good.